Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 4 of Rethinking with Alex Torpy. So picture this. It's a beautiful spring day. Two young fish are in their favorite spot for catching insects. An older fish swims by and says to them, "Hey boys, how's the water today?" The two fish look at each other and say, "What the hell is water?" Now this is a bit that I heard from David Foster Wallace, and it's meant to illustrate the lack of context that we often have for what we see all around us as reality. Now, in this podcast series, we're going to be going and doing a lot of examination of the deep foundational issues with how we govern, talking about how many of the consequences that we see around us can actually be traced back to issues that very few people really talk about or are even aware of, but which are actually the root causes, not the symptoms of what's going on around us. But to do that, we have to become fish that is aware of the water that it's in. We have to discuss how our minds actually work. For millennia, people have had ideas, made decisions, designed systems, and implemented entire governments and societies without accurate knowledge of how many things in the world around them actually worked, including their own brains, beliefs, and behaviors. This distinct lack of self-awareness caused people to act in ways that transposed the subconscious frameworks, biases, and preferences that they inherited but weren't aware of directly into how they acted in the systems that they built, often making decisions and creating systems that weren't actually doing what they thought they were doing, and often which had significant consequences. Think about how many humans have been sacrificed over the years to appease gods into changing weather patterns. But we know that those actions did not accomplish those goals, and really it was just the slaughter of individuals based on false beliefs. As we will examine in more detail as we go here, much of the catastrophic outcomes that we all see and have become somewhat desensitized to that exist widely in our communities, our country, and our world, exist because the systems around us and the people who run them that are supposed to effectively operate our society are built and currently act based on many false assumptions. History will show that many of the assumptions that we have today are not particularly more enlightened than how we view those who sacrificed human lives to change weather patterns. Now, I believe so strongly in the necessity to talk about how our minds work because I believe that mental health, and more broadly, the awareness that we have or don't have about how our brains and minds actually work and why we think and do the things that we think and do, is the common denominator problem of basically every single issue that faces us. If you pretend to be a small child and just take almost any issue and just keep asking why, and why, and why, you will be able to walk things back to points that ultimately relate to how our brains and how our minds work. Now, over the last 10 years, beyond my time as a mayor, a municipal manager, student, professor, entrepreneur, consultant, emergency manager, and volunteer EMT, I've had some real exceptional fortune to get to speak with literally tens of thousands of people about theories of change, governance, and our future. This includes things like panels and workshops at giant conference centers, group meetings in coffee shops and co-working spaces, conversations at motorcycle stops, campfire discussions under the stars in national parks, debates in thatched roof bars, and meetings at the White House. I've had these kinds of conversations in more than 24 states and nearly a dozen different countries. And it's become clear from all of those interactions and from my work and from my studies, there is not one policy issue or election or meme or budget that is standing between us and making systematic change in the way government works, but rather that the greatest cause and greatest threat to building better systems is a lack of knowledge about our own minds and how they work. And we're going to come back to that in future episodes as we dive farther into some of the problems with mental health in this country. So this episode, which is the beginning point of these conversations, is largely about how we each think, have ideas, have conscious awareness, and make decisions, because that all happens in a very different way than you might actually think. And all of this is critically important in understanding why we built systems the way we did, why we operate them the way that we do, and how we can do better. After we examine some of those issues, in the next episode, we'll talk about how some of those dynamics were mostly unintentionally and without awareness, completely infused into the way that we designed political, legal, and economic and cultural systems throughout history, and what the systemic consequences of that are and how our world functions today. These are important foundations to cover before we start talking about any new ideas, because as you'll see from this episode, most analyses of the issues around us only peel back the uppermost couple layers, maybe, when we try and analyze what's going wrong and why things don't work the way they should. But in this podcast, we are going to attempt to peel back every single layer and leave no stone unturned. So I'm going to walk us through a few different pieces to this, and it's going to be a little bit dense, but some of it is probably going to be mind-blowing, so that's something to look forward to. Now, just keep in mind, this isn't going to be an in-depth or scientific explanation necessarily, as we're going to do some more of that in later episodes, and we've got a lot of content to cover today. So first, we're going to talk about a couple definitions. Then we're going to talk about our conception of self and free will and what we get wrong in the idea built into almost everything in the world around us, that we are all fully self-directed, autonomous agents operating in our own environment according to our own conscious ideas. We'll talk about how free will relates to our conscious experience, how it feels to make decisions, and look at medical and scientific evidence that points to how much decision-making is actually happening in our subconscious, not our conscious mind. Then we'll take three lessons about how we can optimize our own lives and the opportunities in redesigning systems around us, which is what the next episode will be about. There's also a ton of additional resources in the show notes with studies and talks from people that are far greater experts than myself. So if you want to dive more into any topic that I cover today, please check those out. So first, when I use the word decision or the phrase decision-making, this is really just meant to be kind of a catch-all. It's meant to apply to any sort of decision that we might make, whether it's a kind of big abstract decision, like who we are, our identity, or what our goals are in life. Or maybe it's a more long-term but tangible decision, like how we manage our cholesterol or what we're doing about climate change. Or it could be a really small decision, like what you wear on a given day or what you have for lunch or how you responded to that coworker. It's just really, now there are important differences between different types of decisions that we may get into in a more deep dive episode, but really for our purposes, it's just a catch-all term for kind of all the decisions that we make. Second, I will likely be only using the phrase subconscious going forward, but this is sometimes used interchangeably with the word unconscious. Now, subconscious is referring to the parts of our brain and processes that happen in our brain that happen without our conscious awareness. That's what that is referring to. All right, so let's dive into self, free will, and our understanding of our own identity and agency. On August 1st, 1966, Charles Whitman, a former U.S. Marine, opened fire from the University of Texas clock tower, killing 18 and injuring 30 people in what at the time was the deadliest mass shooting in the U.S. by a lone gunman. Now, this clock tower shooting came after he had fatally stabbed his mother and his wife the night before at home. And that was after he had been complaining for months of having uncontrollable violent urges that he had no way of explaining. He had visited a number of doctors, a psychiatrist, tried different interventions, a prescription or two, nothing worked. On the day that he killed his mother and his wife, he wrote suicide notes and made various other entries and notes in his journals for people to see about what had been happening. Here's one excerpt from that. I do not quite understand what it is that compels me to type this letter. Perhaps it is to leave some vague reason for the actions I have recently performed. I do not really understand myself these days. I am supposed to be an average, reasonable, and intelligent young man. However, lately, and I cannot recall when it started, I have been a victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts. These thoughts constantly reoccur, and it requires a tremendous mental effort to concentrate on useful and progressive tasks. End quote. Now, an autopsy was performed, which he actually requested in one of the notes, because he wanted people to understand why he did these things. So he was killed by a police officer and a civilian. And when that autopsy was performed, the ME initially suggested they found a brain tumor, but they initially suggested that there was no link, there are no possible link between that brain tumor and his violent behavior. However, many people disagreed, and the governor of Texas commissioned a task force made up of various neurological and medical experts. They came to a different conclusion about what type of tumor it was, found that it was pressing on his amygdala, and suggested that it was possible that there was a link between the tumor and the kind of violent and aggressive behavior that he had been displaying. Now, the important point here is not whether this tumor, in this case, produced these actions or not. Don't get stuck on that question. The important point is using this as a thought experiment. Let's say that medical experts found, without a doubt, that the tumor did directly contribute to or cause his behavior, which is entirely possible, if not the likely outcome. Would that change our perception of his guilt? Who is the his that was guilty? Is it his brain without the tumor? Is it his brain with the tumor? Is the tumor, being a physical outgrowth of him, part of him? Now, certainly a person cannot be blamed for the growth of a tumor in their brain. It is not something that you can consciously exert control over, much less be even aware of most of the time. If the tumor caused the behavior, and let's say it was removed, and medical experts were confident that there was nothing left in his brain that contributed to the violent behavior, where does that leave our understanding of his guilt for those actions? Had he not been killed, would that change how we treat him? What if he had been zapped by some sort of futuristic weapon that changes how the brain works? What if he had been unintentionally poisoned or drugged, and the poison or drug provoked the behavior that he would have never done otherwise? If a person was drugged without their knowledge, let's say with bath salts, which can cause incredibly aggressive and violent behavior, would we blame the person who is unknowingly drugged, or might we blame the person who did the drugging? Most of us would probably consider the person who is unknowingly drugged a victim, not a perpetrator. And that the person under the influence of a drug like that is not responsible for their actions during those times. Let's try a different example. This takes us to Mary. Mary was a circus elephant in the 1900s in Tennessee. And one day, Mary killed one of her handlers who was riding on her back, who potentially had prodded her, poked her in a particular spot that a later autopsy revealed was a massively infected tooth. Now, people were outraged at this. Even after the elephant had calmed down, various people tried to kill her for taking this human life. So the circus owner secured equipment that's used in the construction and maintenance of train and train tracks and lynched the elephant in front of a crowd of 2,500 cheering people and families from this crane-like device. On the first attempt, the chain actually broke, and the elephant came crashing to the ground, shattering her hip. They tried again, and this time successfully killed the elephant. Now, most of us can look at this and agree that taking intentional, painful, punitive revenge on an elephant by hanging it in a public space for doing something wrong, especially when most likely she was set off because someone poked her in a painful spot, which is not a particularly good idea to do to an animal, most of us can look at that and see that this is crazy and stupid and misguided and probably cruel, especially to an animal that we have a relatively good idea has some experience of the world and has experience of things like fear and pain. And most of us wouldn't treat an animal like that anymore. Now, what if a tree fell on your house? Should we punish the tree for causing damage or injuring people? Should we take the tree into a public square, call together the townspeople, and break out our favorite chainsaw, slicing the tree to pieces while children dance in the sawdust, and neighbors take turns chopping at it with an axe, inflicting punishment on this tree that hurt them? No, that would be crazy. Here's one more example, and this goes out to all you cat people out there. This is something that some of you may have vaguely heard about before, and it's called Toxoplasma gondii. It's an amoeba that lives most likely undetected in 60 million Americans. This wonderful little creature starts its life out in cat feces, and ultimately it's hoping to make it to the gut of a warm-blooded animal, especially for rats. Now, once inside the rat's stomach, it can multiply or lay dormant and burrow itself in various places throughout the animal. It is very easily transferred to humans also, and although it will usually show no symptoms, it can cause moderate to severe flu-like symptoms or much more life-threatening reactions in people who have some certain existing medical conditions. But now this is the weird part. It is believed to also change your brain chemistry in a very specific way. Studies have shown that this amoeba, in a brilliant little plan to reproduce itself, reduces the feeling of fear in rats that are infected by it, in some cases actually making the rats sexually aroused by the smell of a cat. I think you can guess what happens next. Rat meet cat, goodbye rat. Now, there are a number of studies that link this amoeba to schizophrenia and mental illness in humans, and there are some who believe that the infection with this parasite leads humans to actually take more risk-taking behavior. Now, it's pretty easy to look at the situation and agree that a rat infected with an organism that directly alters the brain chemistry of the rat in a way such that it's not under its own control when it runs longingly into the awaiting jaws of our dear mittens. But part of what I'm trying to communicate here is that there is not a binary state where in one state, we are fully in control of everything that we do as fully self-directed agents, and then in some other state, some acute thing is happening, such as being drugged or having a parasite. But rather, we exist in a much more amorphous state of things, constantly influencing, nudging, or dictating our behavior every minute of every day. And this is just like how we can observe how these things work for every single other living thing on this planet, even the ones that have some conscious experience, that we believe have some conscious experience. Now, as scientific research in this field continues, we have and will continue to become increasingly aware of the vast number of things that we understand to impact on our behavior, some of which we're going to discuss more shortly. We live in a world where our beliefs and actions are significantly impacted by things that we have no awareness of. Whether it is the newly understood role that bacteria in our gut play in our cognitive processes, or studies that show that judges are more likely to grant parole to someone if they had just eaten prior to the parole hearing, or that people have reduced racial biases if they are primed with positive images of other races beforehand, or that people are likely to have less extreme moral judgments if they wash their hands recently. Now, this is important to think about because everything around us was built by people who didn't know any of this information and therefore weren't able to account for it in how they design the systems that we inherit and use to run the world. Nor do most of the people who run those systems that understand these things as well. And these systems and those people who run the systems make the assumptions that we are all completely self-guided agents able to make our own decisions, when the reality is, as we will examine further, this is actually not how things work. This deeply buried assumption creates a serious mismatch that is the beginning point to a number of suboptimal outcomes we see from ourselves and our leaders and the systems that we have today. For example, let's continue with the context of the criminal justice system for a moment. Should it take intentions into account? when we are thinking about punishing for crimes. Where would intentions get measured from? Does having a parasite that control your brain chemistry mitigate it? What about a tumor pushing on a section of your brain? What about a chemical imbalance in your brain caused by an environmental factor? What about a life of abuse and violence inflicted by parents or your environment? At some point, let's remember that all people, including the worst person you can think of, so go ahead and picture the worst person, whoever you think the worst person in the world is. That person at one point was a fertilized egg and then an infant, born inheriting a genetic makeup and into an environment that they had no control over choosing. If you keep going backwards in time with anyone, there is a point where all of us would likely agree that the person isn't really responsible for creating themselves or being themselves. Yet our conception of people's responsibility for themselves changes at some point. And our criminal justice system and society assumes that as you live, and that at some certain point, you become fully free and able to make whatever choice you want to, even though there's almost no available scientific evidence that points to that actually being true. So how should punishment work? Is it meant to inflict pain onto a conscious being for doing something that we think that they know is wrong and could have decided not to do? What if that being can't control their actions? Do we still punish them? Or is punishment meant to merely protect ourselves from them? We blame, reward, feel shame, feel pride, and judge ourselves and others all in ways that are based on the assumption that any person could have done something different if they wanted to. Think about the kinds of things that you think about other people on a daily basis. Think about what you hear in conversation, on social media, in the news. Think especially about how people talk about people when they are suggesting that someone else is wrong about something. All of that language, and you can pause this and look at a news website real quick if you want to, it's almost all going to be based on the assumption that the subject of the statements could do things differently if they wanted to. Reflect for a moment on what this language would look like if we lived in a world of automatons, machines that were part of a collective that had no independent decision-making capability, or were just carrying out some sort of programming. Maybe a Borg or Data for those Star Trek fans out there. Now, if we were all just computers carrying out programs that we didn't write, none of us would talk about pride and shame or right and wrong or responsibility in the same way. You wouldn't blame an individual for doing something wrong. Maybe you would blame the thing that programmed them. If one of those pre-programmed androids was violent, you would still take measures to protect everyone from them, but you probably wouldn't inflict pain upon them for the joy that you would experience of watching another being consciously suffer to make up for the harm that it caused to someone else because it made a bad decision and it could have made a better decision. It just wouldn't make any sense. I might even argue that it doesn't make sense to try and inflict that pain onto someone, even if they are in control, but it is certainly easily observably illogical to do so if the thing has no ability to make its own decisions. It would just be cruel. It would be like violently punishing an infant for doing something wrong. You wouldn't try and embarrass or shame or hurt a hurricane or a tornado or a flood or a lightning bolt for causing damage, but you sure would still protect yourself from them. So to recap for a second, we all probably, hopefully, agree that inflicting painful vengeance against an elephant, a tree, a flood, a lightning bolt, an animal affected with a parasite, or a pre-programmed computer doesn't make a lot of sense. But the problem is that there is almost no scientific evidence that shows that humans have any greater capacity for self-guided decision-making than any of those examples that I gave. And in fact, the majority of scientists and philosophers don't actually believe that humans have the free will that it feels like, and that if we do have free will, it's much, much more limited than it feels like on a daily basis. Try to imagine for a moment how broad the implications of this actually are in the way not just our criminal justice system might work, but our legal system at large, political and economic systems, our media environment, our culture, and everything else. So let's talk a little bit about free will specifically. Now, to start, most of us probably understand that in physical spaces, we can generally observe physical cause and effects, right? We see something happen and we can identify a cause that prompted that thing to happen. And that process of cause and effect happens according to various laws that we know well enough that they have a really remarkable predictive power. Pretty basic tenet of science, right? Cause and effect. Okay, now there are two places that we do understand fairly conclusively that don't always conform to these direct cause and effect rules. The first is at a quantum level. This is the foundational level that we understand of all energy and matter, strings and quarks and such. At this level, a whole bunch of truly mind-bending things happen, including things existing in multiple states at the same time, quantum elements being in instant communication with each other over distances of light years, processes that actually act differently depending on whether they are under observation or not. And for our purposes, what's most relevant is that there is a degree of randomness that happens, or what we believe to be randomness, that happens at the quantum level. Now, if we zoom all the way out to a macro level, chaos theory also provides us some, though not exactly the same, idea of randomness. That basically, as systems get more complex, the predictability falls below 100%, and there are things that sort of happen outside of that. There's a good scene in Jurassic Park where Jeff Goldblum's character is talking about this a little bit. Now, everything else we understand follows these cause and effect laws, and those two areas of randomness don't necessarily provide an argument in favor of any free will. They just more likely provide an argument against one particular type of philosophy that suggests that every action in existence is playing out along a singular pathway that is unfolding since the Big Bang, that there's only one predetermined option for how everything unfolds. This is a very strong determinism philosophy, sometimes called fatalism, which suggests that everything is playing out basically as it is, and there's really nothing else. Then you have determinists who might be less strict, who broadly believe in these physical cause and effect laws, but may allow for some randomness in the two examples for that we mentioned a moment ago. Now you also have theories that fall under a label of indeterminism, for example, which is probably where most people fall, in a category often referred to as libertarian free will. This is the most popular belief among the general population, and it's also the one that is almost certainly not true. There are philosophies that fall under compatibilism, that sort of combine determinism and indeterminism versus incompatibilism. And there's a handful of other theories that fall in different places. And I'm not trying to give an overview or summary of these positions, which we may do in a later episode, but just give you a sense of the spectrum of what's out there, and that most people fall under this free will category. Now, this libertarian free will is basically the idea that people have kind of intuitively based on our experiences of living. And it goes something like this, that we are a fully self-guided conscious operator, sort of feels like there's a person in a control booth behind your eyes. Right, getting information from all these different sensors through your senses, pulling levers and pushing buttons to make things happen based on this information. You feel pain, so you move your arm. You want a glass of water, you reach for the glass. You think about wanting to apply for that job, you start to think about how to do that and then sit at your computer and start working on your resume. When most people think of themselves, who they are, they think of that conscious little dude in the control room making these decisions as a aware, conscious actor. And we have the feeling that we could have done something other than what we did. And that feeling, the belief that we could do something other than that we did, that we had the free ability to choose something else but just didn't in that case, is really the bedrock of the belief that most of us have as we navigate our lives. But if your brain is a physical object, which it certainly is, and your actions are physical actions, which they certainly are, then it would make sense that we can trace the cause and effect pathways back at least some of the steps. Now, we can't really do that to ourselves minute by minute, although we'll come back to this. But when we study this with medical imaging and sensory technology, so galvanic skin responses, functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRIs, or electroencephalographs, or EEGs, that measure brain activity, we find that the control room dude is actually not being fed information that come from sensors, that come from the outside directly into consciousness, but rather that all the data going to your consciousness is first going through your subconscious before anything ever makes it to the control room dude. And actually, beyond the fact that everything passes through your subconscious first, which we'll talk about more in a moment, it turns out that often your subconscious is actually making the decisions with your conscious mind just along for the ride. Though sometimes your conscious can be convinced that it made the decision for certain reasons, and in some strange phenomenons that we'll cover, it turns out that that was a lie perpetuated by different parts of your brain. Basically, there's a massive system of filters set up that take in enormous amounts of data, then serve up what it thinks might be relevant to your conscious mind. What you get has been massively manipulated, organized, summarized, and altered in ways that you have no real access to. Now, upon a brief reflection, this should be pretty obvious, right? For example, most of us know that our brain inverts and merges the sensory data that we get from the two different eyes that we have into one cohesive image. A perfectly natural or unmodified vision might look something like two confusingly overlapping kind of circular images that are upside down and that or have a whole bunch of things about them that would make it basically impossible for us to actually use effectively. For example, when your eyes move side to side, if you're like scanning a horizon, you're not actually capturing the smooth image that it looks like, but rather it's a very low frame rate of static images that your brain actually merges into something that is made to look smooth. But in the process, it eliminates information the same way a computer might when it's compressing something. So some people who have special technical or tactical training are sometimes trained to not scan a horizon or their environment by looking smoothly across it, but actually by looking at certain points at different distances along the horizon, because by doing that, you reduce that process of your brain merging images together, and you're more likely to have an anomaly that you actually need to see eliminated by your brain. But it's important to understand that our brain is frequently patching gaps in sensory data, realigning the timing of signals, and it does all of these things to keep the information flow to our conscious manageable and specifically tailored to exactly what we need on a minute-by-minute basis to maximize our survival from a biological perspective and absolutely nothing more. The idea that our subconscious, well beyond our perception, gets first crack at every single bit of data is not a wild theory. It's an observable, repeatable, scientific understanding that modern technology has allowed us to see. Beyond our eyes playing tricks on us, let's go into some examples. First is a study from 2008 which involved fMRI scans of brains that measured the brain activity of people when they were given a task to press one of two different levers. And this showed that the subconscious mind knew what decision was going to be made seconds before the person was aware that they had made a decision. The authors of the study said, quote, "We found that the outcome of a decision can be encoded in brain activity of prefrontal and parietal cortex up to 10 seconds before it enters awareness. This delay presumably reflects the operation of a network of high-level control areas that begin to prepare an upcoming decision long before it enters awareness." End quote. A 2009 study found that our subconscious was able to access memories and proceed along with decision-making without our conscious mind being aware that that was actually happening. And a 2012 study found that your subconscious brain can actually perform math without your conscious brain being aware of it. Researchers showed that by showing people quick flashes of a math problem through a process called continuous flash suppression, so this means that they are being shown an image so quickly that their conscious brain isn't aware that they've seen an image or that they've seen anything at all, that when those people were given the math problems to then solve consciously, those who had seen it subconsciously solved the problems faster and or with less errors than those who didn't see it. So the subconscious was working on the math problem before the conscious brain even knew that it had seen a math problem. Now, these studies are all linked in the show notes, and there are many, many studies on these subjects. And again, these are all using modern brain imaging technology that paint a very vivid picture of what is happening compared to what we thought decades or centuries ago, when basically all of the general ideologies of how the world works that we believe were created. It paints a picture for us that our consciousness is merely the tip of the iceberg, not the place where most of the cognition is happening, and that consciousness is not the beginning of a chain of events, but actually might be happening at or towards the end. And it's been primed or outright dictated by processes that have happened totally outside of the conscious awareness. You may also want to check out the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. That has some cool examples of studies. But this is also something that most of us kind of know. You know, we know what a gut feeling is. We know what a hunch is. We know what a bad feeling or intuition are. Those things are not made up. These are actually observable scientific phenomenon about how our brains process information. Now, if a bunch of scientific experiments and peer-reviewed journals is not your cup of tea, let's try a quick thought experiment so you can experience the sensation a little bit firsthand. Now, I've seen this in a few different places, but I originally found this from a really great Sam Harris talk about free will, which is also linked in the show notes. So I'm going to ask you a question, and then I'm going to ask you a question, the same question again, but kind of ask you to try to reflect on your how your thinking process happened the second time around, or the first time around if you can. So the question is, I'd like you to think of the name of a city. You are free to choose any city, just pick the name of a city. Okay, put that city aside for a second. Now do the same thing again, think of the name of a city. But try to pay attention to how that unfolds in your mind. Now, let me ask you all a question. Did any of you think of the city Trenton, New Jersey? I know one or two of you who might be watching who did. But for most of you out there, and this can be any city name that you didn't think of, but let's just use Trenton. Many of you have probably heard of Trenton, but you didn't pick it. Now, did you think about it in your conscious state or your unconscious state? What most people reflect happens when they are asked this question is the following. Most people will say that the question is asked, and at some point in the few seconds following that, a few cities come into their awareness. It might be the words of the cities written out. It might be a visual representation of the city. It might be a memory of visiting the city, something like that. But something comes into your consciousness such that you are aware of New York and Tokyo and London, let's say. And then you think of those three cities. And you've got those in your mind. And then your conscious mind kicks in and says, all right, New York, Tokyo, and London. Well, I don't want to say New York because that's where I am right now. That's kind of lame. Tokyo, I don't know. All right, I'm going to say London. And then you think, and then London is the one that you chose. Now, if you did not consciously think of the city Trenton, were you, but you have heard of it, which everybody should, especially if you're familiar with American history at all. If you didn't nominate the name of Trenton into your consciousness, were you free to choose that option? And the real answer here is that we don't really know. Because we don't know how things came from not being in your awareness to then becoming in your awareness. Assuming for a moment that we have any conscious ability to make free decisions, right? We're just saying that we don't really know how things come from the subconscious to the conscious. Now, I know this is a little crazy to think about, right? That no thought enters your conscious mind until it's been evaluated or potentially altered by your subconscious and then given the A-OK to be passed along to your conscious. Your conscious mind gets an extremely small amount of the total information. Yet, if our conscious mind is who we are and who we are when we make decisions, isn't that a problem if it's making decisions in a way where you cannot actually see how it's doing so? Even if we believe that we can make a conscious decision once we've got the names of the cities in our consciousness, which the scientific evidence does not necessarily suggest is possible, the information our conscious brain got was extremely limited based on the available options. So take the city's example. Let's say you know the name of 1,000 different towns or cities, and I asked you that question. Now, you thought of 3 different cities. So that means that if you know 1,000 of them, and you probably know that many or more, 997 of them, 99.7% of the available choices that you had were eliminated before your conscious mind entered the equation, and you don't know how or why those 997 options were actually eliminated. You don't know why those 3 necessarily came to your mind. And in fact, you may even tell yourself a story about why, but as we'll come back to in a little bit, sometimes those stories are made up. So it's really actually kind of a difficult question. Were you free to choose Trenton or not? And this has really significant implications, that the fact that our conscious mind is only getting information that has been vetted extremely strictly by our subconscious mind. So it's important to pause on that for a moment and wrap our heads around that fact of the way that brains work. Now, I know that it feels like we are the ones making the decisions, and we can often go back and explain why we made a decision, but it turns out that our brains were masters at producing fake news well before the mainstream media was. In a process referred to as confabulation, we can scientifically observe the brain completely making up explanations for things that it doesn't know. But we, the speakers of those false justifications, the conscious actors, are not aware when or that our brains made them up. And the way that we can study this is from a really cool and kind of weird phenomenon, one of the weirder ones that I've come across that you can observe through split-brain experiments. These split-brain experiments started in the 1960s in studies that ended up later winning the Nobel Prize. Roger Sperry and colleagues conducted studies on people who had a certain type of epilepsy. The only treatment for this type of epilepsy was cutting something called the corpus callosum, which connects the two hemispheres of the brain. These original experiments found that, for example, each hemisphere was good at certain tasks. For example, the right side being more creative and the left being more analytical. That's where that came from. But what's totally bizarre is what actually came in some of the subsequent studies. Now, I'm just going to read an excerpt from Jonathan Haidt's book, The Happiness Hypothesis, because he summarizes these studies pretty well. So, and remember, these are split-brain studies where the two hemispheres are disconnected so they can't talk to each other. And the left eye communicates to the right hemisphere, right, and the right eye to the left hemisphere. We understand the body is divided that way. So when the researchers flashed different patterns to the two hemispheres, things grew weirder. On one occasion, he flashed a picture of a chicken claw on the right and a picture of a house and a car covered in snow on the left. The patient was then shown an array of pictures and asked to point to the ones that go with what he had seen. The patient's right hand pointed to the picture of a chicken, which went with the chicken claw that the left hemisphere had seen. But the left hand pointed to a picture of a shovel, which went with the snow scene presented to the right hemisphere. However, when the patient was asked to explain his two responses, he didn't say, "I don't know why my left hand is pointing to a shovel. It must be something you showed my right brain." Instead, the left hemisphere instantly made up a plausible story. The patient said, without any hesitation, "Oh, that's easy. The chicken claw goes with the chicken, and you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed." This finding that people will readily fabricate reasons to explain their own behavior is called confabulation. Confabulation is so frequent in work with split-brain patients that other people suffering brain damage that Gazzaniga, the researchers, refer to the language centers on the left side of the brain as the interpreter module, whose job it is to give a running commentary on whatever the self is doing, even though the interpreter module has no access to the real causes or motives of the self's behavior. For example, if the word walk is flashed to the right hemisphere, the patient may stand up and walk away. When asked why he is getting up, he might say, "I'm going to get a Coke." The interpreter module is good at making up explanations, but not knowing that it has done so. End quote. Really, really, really weird, right? Now, implicit racial biases, for example, are one of the many types of biases that we'll cover in later episodes, which are able to exist in this subconscious space and sometimes even produce post hoc rationalizations about why we did something a certain way in the past. These biases take hold during the subconscious processing and can have us do something that our conscious minds don't actually want to do. And our conscious minds even may be provided with a made-up reason for why the behavior happened that isn't true, but which we don't know isn't true. Think about the implications for this observable process and how things work. For example, many of us think that people spend lots of time thinking about who they're going to vote for, weighing things like policies and ideologies to make our decisions, but various studies have shown that when people are given pictures of theoretical candidates running for office, where they don't actually realize that those people are or were candidates for office, but for offices they wouldn't recognize, state legislative races or congressional races in history, people are asked to pick who they would vote for. And what's amazing is that the results of those couple second long decision-making processes are often remarkably similar to the outcomes that we actually observed in the real world. We also know this from the marketing world and various other fields, that people tend to actually make the decisions with more deep emotional parts of their brain and then use rational explanations to justify those choices. There's a Simon Sinek talk linked in the show notes that goes into this kind of from a marketing perspective as well. So at minimum, there is an enormous amount of vetting of all data, information, thoughts, and ideas before they get to the conscious part of your brain. And take that city's example. Even if we discover the mechanism that allows for self-directed control in that conscious part, the vast majority of the vetting, more than 99%, happened almost instantly and in a way that you don't have any awareness over in that time. You can't decide minute by minute which things your subconscious feeds to your consciousness. So in the absolute best case scenario of arguing for having any free will, you have, let's say, something like 99%, and probably more than that, of all the data eliminated before it comes to your consciousness by a subconscious that has its own agenda and preferences and biases that you may not be aware of. So let's say we're in a room together, and you gave me the opportunity to choose an apple from 1,000 different apples. But 995 of the apples were camouflaged or invisible in some way, so I can't actually see them. I can only see 5 apples. And you ask me to go pick one. Now, I'm going to feel like I have control because I see the 5 apples, and I'm going to pick them up, and I'm going to inspect them, and I'm going to poke them and prod them and smell them, and I'm probably going to end up choosing a mealy one because I feel like I always am bad at choosing apples. But I would feel like I made the decision, and in fact, I would probably blame myself. Oh, Alex, why can't you do better at picking a ripe piece of fruit from the grocery store or from this table of 5 apples? I would use rationality to determine the best apple, and I would choose it, and I would think that my choice of that 1 out of the 5 was done in a rational way, which is not necessarily true. However, I also wouldn't know that 995 of the possible options were taken away from me before I even had the chance to look at them. So the control that I felt in that situation, which itself is arguable, and we're going to discuss that a little more, is only based on my lack of knowledge about how much what I saw had been vetted before I was aware of it. The city's example operates the same way. And in fact, every single decision that you have ever made or will ever make basically operates the same way. This is simply how our minds work. Again, these are not wild theories or radical ideas. This is the best case scenario for agency based on modern scientific understanding. But because most of us feel like we have control over our decisions on a daily basis in our conscious experience, we just sort of accept without really ever thinking about it that we live in a world that's organized around everyone being fully self-directed conscious actors. Okay, so far, you should be beginning to see how many layers exist in any given process before you are aware you're even working on an idea or thought or decision. And those layers go back to your subconscious, your environment, your genetic and cultural inheritance, your parents' genetic and cultural inheritance, and their parents, and back thousands and millions of years. All of that history precedes anything that any of us ever do. In fact, your idea that we live in a world full of people freely making their own decisions about what to do is not a decision that you made to think in 2020 or 2021. Rather, it is the nearly universal belief of every person and every system around you that you were born into and inherited without question from a very early age. Assumptions like this are so deeply ingrained in us that most of us never even realize we can ask a question about them and that there is an assumption that we can discuss. And we certainly never think about the implications of these assumptions in how our leaders function and how our systems and societies work. Now, each one of you listening to this right now was born into a world that had thousands and millions of years of this precedent right before you, whether biological or cultural or anything else, that all developed before the idea of you existed. Genetic predispositions that you have no control over. And you came into an environment and a culture and a family that you also had no control over. You didn't choose what town you were born in. You didn't choose what time period you were born into. You didn't choose your gender or your race. You didn't choose what jobs your parents had or what religious beliefs were part of your upbringing. You didn't choose any of these things. Your ideas about the world weren't created out of thin air, but were massively influenced at minimum and perhaps entirely dictated at maximum by everything that happened before you outside of your control. And you can actually find some interesting studies that show that even cultural beliefs begin to be imparted on an infant within minutes after it is born, based on the way it is handled and treated. So everything that you do or think is a layer on top of a layer on top of a layer that have been accumulating in the seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years, decades, centuries, millennia before that thing happened. That is also how our systems are designed. And it's not just how our identities and behaviors are created. and it's also how our brains developed. And we can examine some really interesting research that shows that this is literally how different parts of our brain developed over time. This is going to be a little bit surprising to some of you. So there are a number of studies that point to this strange phenomenon that I'm about to describe, and they're linked to in the show notes. So in one of them, participants were given a questionnaire to fill out as part of the study. One group had a regular survey, which had an open-ended question asking to recount a prior life experience, whether good or bad. Another group had a survey that asked specifically about a past action that you took that was immoral or sinful. So people go through doing the study, and at the end of it, participants were offered a clicky pen or a small container of hand sanitizer. Remember, this is pre-COVID. Now, the group with the neutrally worded question, about half took the pen and about half took the hand sanitizer. Do you want to wager a guess about what happened for the people who answered the question about a sinful experience? The majority of them took the hand sanitizer. Now, the same researchers performed a number of other experiments that seemed to confirm the behaviors that that study found, and they suggest that the brain equates moral cleanliness with physical cleanliness, and that the parts of our brain that develop later to sort of intellectualize ideas about moral cleanliness are actually layered on top of the parts of the brain that think about physical cleanliness. And some of this shouldn't actually be surprising in some historical literature that you might read about physical cleanliness habits. And this phenomenon actually works in the reverse as well, because what you can find is that based on whether someone washed their hands recently or not, that can actually be predictive of the reaction in situations that require a moral judgment, in that people who had recently washed their hands tend to have less extreme moral judgments. Now, there are many studies that we've already talked about that show how our behavior can be changed by events that we would never connect, such as the judges more likely to offer parole after eating, or another one that I thought is particularly interesting, where people will actually describe someone's personality, who they met briefly, they're more likely to describe that person's personality as warm and friendly if, when they met the person, somebody briefly asked them to hold a warm cup of coffee. They're more likely to say the person was warm and friendly versus if they met someone who asked them to hold a cup of iced coffee. So people thought the personality of the person was more friendly because the temperature of the beverage that they were holding when they met the person. But even more importantly than the fact that the way that we think and come up with our ideas are extremely biased and based off of things that we don't really have a ton of access to, is that just like this, the systems, which we're going to talk more about next week, and our brains and our bodies, all of these things are built in these layers over time. Nothing is just starting out. Everything is sort of being inherited from something else, with incremental changes being built on top of things over very long time periods. And those are the things that got us to where we are. Now, this is extremely important to keep in mind, the layering of things over time, like rocks in the crust of the earth, because it's important to understand that we are not some exceptional final product of this process, which is what people believed before Charles Darwin, for example, but active participants in the processes that are unfolding all around us. The idea that we are the only fully self-directed agent in the world, in existence, even though we really don't think that about other living creatures, is a really similar exceptionalism to people who didn't believe that we evolved from other animals, but rather that we were magically placed here on the earth in the form that we are in. Both of these ideas consider humans as some separate thing from all of the physical laws that are around us, but in reality, what we really do know now is that we are just one of many. And sure, we're unique and have some specific things about us that are kind of cool, but we are operating as part of the process that all of the other physical living things around us are operating in. Now, we're not going to get into the biological or evolutionary history in this episode, because we will in an episode soon. But the main thing I think that everyone generally knows is that we evolve, other people who evolve from primates, who evolve from animals before that, going all the way back to incredibly simplistic life forms. But that process of evolution, it's important to understand, it's not just about whether we walk upright or on all fours or how much hair we have on our body or things like that. It's about our brains and our minds and our beliefs and how we think of and see the world around us. All of these things are evolved incremental layers that are built over time, over thousands and millions of years. Okay, so we've covered a lot so far. We talked about the idea of self and played a little with some examples where it's pretty clear that the thing that took an action wasn't really acting under its own free will. We talked about the implications for that specifically with the criminal justice system for a moment, but also how this relates to basically every system in the world around us. We talked about how free will does not actually exist in the way that most of us think that it does, if it exists at all. We talked about how important of a role our subconscious actually plays in either strictly vetting information that comes to our consciousness or outright making the decisions, sometimes doing so in ways where we fabricate lies without our own knowledge of that to justify why we did something. And we talked about how our beliefs in these things and the world around us work, and that all of these beliefs, in addition to our brains and our bodies and systems, are all layers built on earlier layers built on earlier layers, that each layer gets us kind of farther away from being able to see some of the original assumptions that we made. Now, Jerry Seinfeld kind of joked about this, that every time he painted his apartment, he could feel it closing in on him, getting a little bit smaller, and eventually just leaving a hole where the outlet used to be. It's kind of like that. Now, this is going to be the kind of last piece of the puzzle for today. I've used the word consciousness a lot, so let's just spend a moment talking about what that means and what we know about it. At one point in our evolutionary timeline, we likely did not have the consciousness that we have now, which is this very vivid and highly specific, tangible and communicable experience of the world around us. Each of us is aware of what this experience is, and some even argue that this experience, our consciousness, is actually the only thing in the world that we actually know for sure to exist. Thomas Nagel wrote a fascinating paper in the 1970s called What Is It Like to Be a Bat, trying to imagine what it is like for your primary sensory experience not to be eyesight, but to be echolocation, and that your primary experience in as a bat might feel like maybe some really strange combination of sight and touch, and that is how they quote-unquote see. Now, he and many others have suggested that consciousness is basically if it's like something to be a thing. We don't really expect that it's like anything to be a grain of sand or a rock. And although we expect that it's maybe mildly like something to be a fish or a bee, we do believe that it's like something to be a dog or a human. Now, there's actually no agreed upon scientific theory on why or how consciousness even evolved. And I don't want to go down that rabbit hole today because we're going to come back to that in a later episode too. But the basic takeaway here is that we have consciousness and that all other living things have some type of consciousness, maybe, but it's not exactly like ours. And that at some point, the animals that we evolved from didn't have consciousness the same way that we do today. Now, this consciousness, our subjective experience of the world, we also don't have an agreed upon theory for the mechanisms that actually produce it on a daily basis. There are some, often called materialists or sometimes physicalists, who believe that consciousness is basically just the sum of physical processes happening in our brains, and that there really isn't anything more than that. It's a complex integrated system, and that complex system produces consciousness in the chemical reactions that are happening in the brain. There are some dualists who believe that there are physical and non-physical components to consciousness. Each of these theories has some logical and in some cases scientific paradoxes that seem to suggest they might actually not be able to be true. And there is fierce debate in the scientific and philosophical communities about this. There are also other theories, such as ones falling under panpsychism, that promise some really interesting potential unifications and provide, in my own personal belief, potentially a space for some type of conscious free will to exist, albeit on top of all of these other layers that we have already discussed. So much more constrained than we possibly thought. We're not going to go down that rabbit hole today either. But all this is meant to say that scientists do not actually have an understanding or agreement about the underlying mechanisms that produce or evolved consciousness. But modern science has provided some really interesting tools to poke around and understand more than people could 50 years ago, a bunch of those which we covered earlier in the episode. But the main point is this. Most of us feel like consciousness is the beginning point of things happening. But the reality is that it is happening more closer to the end of a chain of events. The earlier steps in the chain not being things that we have real awareness of. The famous philosopher John Searle, I think, said it really well. He basically said that if you had never seen an ocean or a wave before and had no understanding of water or science or waves, you might look at a wave and think that the white foamy tip at the edge of the wave crashing is pulling the wave forward. The wave is moving forward. This thing is at the front of it. It stands to reason that based on the way a lot of things around us appear to work, where the front is pulling something, that the wave is being pulled forward. But of course, we understand that the foam at the end of a crashing wave is not pulling the wave forward, but rather the wave is moving forward based on processes that are happening much deeper and kind of behind the scenes that are much harder for us to obviously observe. Consciousness most likely is the same thing. And it means that our capacity for completely self-directed, conscious-free decision-making is very, very different than what we may have thought. It means that the vast majority of our cognition is happening based on things that we don't know much about and that happened and were primed over thousands and tens of thousands and millions of years, happening more recently in parts of our brain that we don't really have any access to. It means that for millennia, people have been creating ideas, building systems, running societies with a very fundamental misunderstanding of how brains and thinking actually work, but all of which we inherited individually and systemically. Now, some of this might sound a little bit frightening, which is good, because that means that you're really wrapping your head around these ideas, which really are truly bizarre, especially if you're kind of thinking about them for the first time. And I'll share with you, certainly, when I started learning about these things, I was worried what a society would be like with people who don't think there's free will. Everybody's just going to kind of sit around or be bad to other people. But what actually is that the less free will that people think that people have, the more generous they end up being, which is not actually that surprising because if you think that the mechanisms that inform other people's decisions are influenced by factors outside of their control. Now, there are three main lessons from all of this that I want to talk about, and these are pretty damn cool. And this is not at all doom and gloom. It's quite the opposite. Number one, we actually do have some really cool access to clues about what's happening in our subconscious that most people don't really take advantage of. Number two, we have the ability to influence our subconscious significantly. It just usually takes a longer amount of time or a bunch of training. And number three, awareness of the facts about how all of this works and the understanding that our leaders and systems operate and have been built in ways that magnify all of these issues actually provides us with an enormous amount of newly discovered freedom and power over our ourselves, our surroundings, and our systems. So first, let's talk about the clues to our subconscious. Our emotional states are probably our most accurate indicator into what is happening in our subconscious on a minute-by-minute basis. It may seem sort of obvious, but it's actually really important to fully understand the implications of this. Because we can't read our subconscious thoughts the way that we can in our mind, where we can sort of visualize things or see words or language or pictures, these things all translate very directly into thoughts that we can understand or actions that we can take. And our subconscious and our emotions don't really do that, we're at a bit of a disadvantage in that regard, especially considering that the vast majority of formative thought is coming from the subconscious mind. But our emotions are related in some way, at minimum, to what is being produced by the subconscious brain as it crunches all the data before serving it to our conscious brain. It might be helpful to think about emotions as like an indicator gauge on a car, giving us an understanding of something that's happening under the hood, far away from our ability to directly observe. Now, it's not showing us the actual thing, but a measurement of the thing. And learning how to be extremely aware of your emotional state, actually being able to observe it in a dispassionate and specific ongoing fashion, is one of the best tools that we have to gain insight into what's actually going on in our heads in any given moment. And it's a bit confusing and sort of abstract and subjective, right? Why does being nervous make my stomach feel like it's doing flips? Why does being mad make my face feel warm? Why does being threatened make my hairs stand up or make me feel that feeling of that kind of fight or flight kicking in? These are really associated with specific thoughts when you really think about it. But it is by far our best connection to our subconscious brain. And in fact, mindfulness and meditation exercises are an accessible mechanism to greatly improve your ability to observe and understand your emotions, rather than just be impacted by them without any chance to exert your own control. And this is not a new concept. The Stoics of the Hellenistic time period, such as Seneca and Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus, they knew this really, really well. But our emotions are treated so poorly in modern times, with specifically bad ways of treating emotions based on really bad and different sex and gender dynamics and assumptions. But this is largely, I think, because people feel kind of controlled by the emotions, so we don't really respect them and the information that they're carrying. We don't really use them to our advantage, we let them use us. But if you think about your emotions as readouts giving you valuable information, it puts them in a whole new light and provides us with a lot of agency over our decisions. So let's think about it this way. You're in a meeting at work, and you're in this meeting, your boss is there, a bunch of other coworkers are there, and in this meeting, you're talking about an idea. You've got a promotion that you're up for at the company, and there's a discussion happening about an idea that you had suggested and that you were hoping to have some ownership over. A coworker jumps in and totally takes the wind out of your sails, cuts your legs out from under you, right? They dismiss you or the idea in some way, and you get that feeling, right? You get that feeling where some adrenaline starts pumping, your face might feel flush, your hairs might stand up, you might shake a little bit, all these different things that are happening, these early stages of a fight or flight response that are happening. And all of us have been in situations like this. And the biological, what's happening in that situation is that our bodies and brains are built to identify threats to ourselves. This has been built over tens and hundreds of thousands of years of not just being a predator, but also being a prey. And so your fight or flight starts to kick in, and your emotions kind of run wild. And probably many of us have been in situations where we jumped in and did something in a way that we later were like, I can't believe I always do that. Why did I talk about it that way? You know, I made myself seem angry or desperate or, you know, short-fused or something, and it didn't come out in your favor. Now, if instead of allowing the emotion to influence your behavior, you look at the emotion as an indicator of how you're feeling and say, oh, there, I'm feeling threatened right now. Okay, am I under some physical threat or not? No, I'm not. Okay, this thing that is happening is a biological predisposition to act in a certain way that I don't need to do right now. And instead, I'm going to let the emotion dissipate, which they typically do, actually, if you allow them to within seconds most of the time. And instead of reacting that way, I'm going to react in a way that's cool, calm, collected, rational, logical, and is going to kind of maximize whatever my goals are, you know, at the company. Understanding this distinction and then practicing it and building that into your life can give you immense clarity and agency in these sorts of decisions. It can really, really change things. It's an enormous amount of power. And for anyone who wants to understand how to make better decisions, understanding how your emotions play into this and how you can use them to make better decisions, not ignore them, is critical. Now, I have a decent intellectual foundation of this concept, and for the last several years, I've incorporated a study of this into my own personal and professional life, including a regular meditation practice. But I am far from feeling totally competent in this regard. I don't want to misrepresent my abilities here, which have grown considerably and have really positively influenced how I live and work, but they still have a long ways to go. But I will tell you, it is remarkable once you really realize what role your emotions can play in your life. Okay, so let's move on to lesson or takeaway number two, which is that our subconscious, we actually do have control over, it just takes longer. Now we talked a little bit about biases before, and I'm gonna do a later episode diving into all of the crazy biases that we have, because there's so many of them, and some of them are so interesting. But it's really important to understand that training and certain frameworks that we implement can have a significant impact on how we do or don't implement certain biases. For example, humans have a bias towards false positives in pattern recognition. That means humans have the tendency to think that there is a pattern in something when there isn't. This is sometimes called a type 1 bias. A false negative bias, or a type 2 bias, would be thinking that there is not a pattern when there is in fact one. This bias towards false positives is believed to have developed from our very early days when we were living as a prey as much as we were a predator. Recognizing odd patterns of shadows in your living space, or hearing something in the bushes, or seeing a pattern in the tall grass were all extremely important to our survival. It was better to think that there was a mountain lion in the grass when there wasn't, to not think that there was one when there was. This trait was evolutionarily preferred, and it spread and passed down over centuries and millennia. And it's something that we all have built into the basic bios of how our brain works. And whether it's a pattern in someone else's behavior that you think you notice, I'm going to link to a particularly funny example of this from the show Key and Peele in the show notes, or patterns in things like seeming like the world is against you, or any other patterns that you think you might be noticing. Many of these are likely produced by an overactive pattern recognition system that creates all sorts of issues for us in our modern environment, where the bulk of your cognition doesn't need to go towards evading predatory animals in the bush, but instead going towards engaging with complex and abstract and interactive systems, media, and people. Now, this false positive pattern recognition is just one of hundreds of biases. And these biases exist in the space between something happening and our conscious becoming aware of that thing happening. But you can retrain yourself. Brains are remarkably resilient or plastic, which means that we can actually rewire our brains in new ways based on training them. I'm not going to get too deep into this because we are going to cover this more in later episodes too. But again, the point here is that your brain has incredible neuroplasticity, and that your subconscious can indeed be influenced by your conscious efforts. It just might take a long period of time. It just can't really be done in a given moment where subconscious thought precedes conscious thought. Now, the third thing or takeaway here is a really, really exciting one. It's maybe the most fun out of all of these. And it's the point that with this awareness of those two other points and everything that we've covered today, is that we have considerably more potential for agency and to make better decisions and to design better systems than it feels like on a daily basis. And I would argue that these systems around us are probably designed, perhaps unintentionally, sometimes intentionally, to actually prevent people from realizing this fact. Think about early social control thousands of years ago. It's much better to give people a little bit of decision-making over areas where they actually don't have any, but don't tell them that, when then you are sort of pulling the strings at the larger level. That's much easier to control large groups of people than convincing people that they have free will and lots of agency to make whatever decisions they want. Now, we have these incredibly powerful brains that we're only beginning to understand, but they operate in ways that are sometimes counterintuitive. But because of the technology that we have some greater visibility into what's happening inside of them, exponentially more than people did 50 years ago or 100 years ago. We have studies and researchers and brilliant people thinking their way through these questions on a daily basis, providing us with an ever-increasing amount of insight into how we actually think. This knowledge is new, and this new knowledge changes the game. This level of self-awareness about how our brains actually work may even, in the future, be seen as a sort of evolutionary step for our species. This remarkable capacity for self-awareness is, I cannot state how much power this can bring to us in our individual lives and in our surroundings and in our systems. The ability to change the outcomes in a world that is built on people not changing those outcomes is really, really powerful. Maybe the most powerful force that we can leverage for change, and probably the most core idea that we can examine about how to make big change. We're going to examine in future episodes, for example, some of the mental health problems that exist in our society, and especially among those in leadership positions, about why things work the way they do. But we can't get to things like that until we cover how the mind and brain actually works and how we think and make decisions. So this has major consequences for you in your own individual personal life. Because being more aware of how you have ideas, form preferences, and make decisions will lead you to be able to make better decisions, combat biases, sidestep decision fatigue, and do all sorts of things that optimize how you and your brain work together to navigate the world more effectively. This is real power. So, for example, people fall for all sorts of tricks that don't help us, and you can overcome them if you are aware of them, even simple ones like in how people think about finance. And I come across this all the time in my experience as a municipal manager or as a mayor, working with people with budgets, even the people who are supposed to know how to do a budget or how to think about finances, I mean, they were often so, so far off. And these are the people making decisions, not to mention the people in the communities who are impacted by those decisions, not really being able to wrap their heads around some of the cognitive biases about finances that we have. So I'll give you one example. So let's say you're planning on buying a new computer. There's a store right near your house, and it's selling the computer for $1,000. There is a store that is an hour away, and they're selling the computer for $500. Most of us would drive an hour each direction to save 50% off that $1,000 computer. However, if we were buying a $30,000 car, and there was a dealership that was right near you, selling it for $30,000, and a dealership that was an hour away where you could save $500 off of it, most people, studies have shown that most people will not drive that hour each way to save the $500 off the car. And that is because there is a bias in how people think about money, where they tend to think about things as percentages that's relative to some other amount. But that is the wrong way to think about it. Because the $500 saved, whether you save it off an item that costs $1,000, $10,000, or $100,000, none of those relative numbers that make up the other half of the percentage have any bearing whatsoever on the value of the $500 saved. It is a flaw in how we think about things. We'll cover in later episodes a bias that gets people to buy things that are more expensive because you can create a false option that nobody chooses that helps upsell people to something more expensive. And these are important in our personal lives because we make a lot of bad decisions about these sorts of things, and you can bet that a lot of marketers know how this works. So you having this information can help combat bad decisions. And like the example that I mentioned about municipal budgets, think about how important it is for the people who are making decisions about finances, where we know that we are biased. We are more likely to spend more money on something if it is discussed or next to something that's really expensive. You could imagine how a bias like that can completely derail the rationality in trying to make good financial decisions from the perspective of government. And if you want to dig into any of these things a little more, I've linked to some Dan Ariely talks in the show notes. He's got a lot of stuff on this. But now, that's actually not the really exciting part. It's pretty cool, don't get me wrong. But remember, the same people who designed and ran the systems that practically every system and institution and element of our society today is based on had no idea about almost any of this stuff. They had no fMRI studies or brain scans or even a field of scientific inquiry that gave any insight into how brains actually functioned. Now, trust me, I'm not judging or blaming anyone in history. In fact, we'll come back to this when we do our episode on ethics and authenticity, because we shouldn't feel any pride for knowing these things now. None of us chose to be born into this time period. We just happened to do so, and they weren't. Nothing to do with them or us. But these people who designed these systems, they thought that people's personalities were dictated by what animals the person's face looked like. That was a real scientific theory, belief. They believed that hanging an elephant from a crane because it killed someone was the right thing to do. They believed that the female orgasm was a sign of mental illness. They believed that certain races or genders were less human than others. They believed that witches sank in water. They believed that heroin could cure diseases. They believed the sun revolved around the earth. They believed that California was an island. Yeah, that theory existed through the 1700s. They believed all sorts of things that we look back on and say, wow, that was crazy. Now, there's two points to this. The first point is that those same people operating under those same frameworks that produce those massive misunderstandings of how the world worked around them designed the legal, political, economic, cultural, and other systems that our entire world is basically based on. And they did so in a way that transposed many of those unconscious biases and things about the way they thought things worked into those systems. Now, don't get me wrong, there's been plenty of brilliant people and brilliant ideas throughout time. And again, this isn't about judging anybody. Rather, it's just pointing out the fact that the majority of predominant beliefs about how the world worked any period of time were wrong. And those beliefs only existed up until some contrarian pointed them out. And those contrarians were often punished or exiled or oppressed or killed. For suggesting those new things. But that people have, history has basically been a never-ending series of being hugely wrong about almost everything. And not only should we be aware of that fact when considering and looking at the historical systems and assumptions that we still use today, but we should use that to remember that today we are still likely in the same boat. Sure, we've got considerably more knowledge than people had before, but we are still incredibly early in our evolution as a species. Did you know that all of recorded human history has taken place in 0.0000014% of the time the Earth has existed? And the Earth is only 4.5 billion years old in a universe that's almost 14 billion years old. We may feel modern, but our entire existence is still extremely, extremely early. Think about the trillions upon trillions of people who will descend from us, who will exist and live for millions of years into the future. And think about how much they're going to know about things compared to us now. The second point is, why should our political systems not be subject to the same level of critique that fields of true scientific inquiry have received? Or our legal system, or the rational actor theory of economics? Do we really think that the blinding ignorance of the medical and scientific people who believe that if your face sort of looked like a frog, you might have a frog-like characteristic, or that to cure someone from a mental illness, you had to shout at the demon that was inside of them, again, to no fault of their own, but do we really think that those same people and those same ideologies that existed, and again, those were the people that were the most educated in thinking through specific things like this, do we really think that they didn't build the same kinds of mistakes into our political and legal and economic systems? And those are systems that don't get anywhere near the level of scientific method applied to them as has been in the fields of medical science or biology, for example. We just keep adding layers and layers on top of these systems without really going back and questioning any of the earlier assumptions that are actually the root causes of a lot of what we're seeing. And I think this is pretty exciting. All of this is very exciting. And I'll put it this way. If 99% of our decision-making is done prior to our awareness through biological evolution and genetics and environment and subconscious, I'd rather, much rather, have an accurate knowledge of the actual agency that I have of the remaining 1% rather than have a false belief that I have control over the 100% of it, when in fact what that means is that I have 0% control. 1% control may not seem like a lot, but it is a hell of a lot more than 0%. I find all of this so exciting. We know things that people couldn't have dreamed of ever knowing 200 years ago. With this knowledge comes the potential for real, authentic freedom and power to be more aware, more self-directed, and more conscious agents who can reshape ourselves and our world considerably more than it seems like, or that we thought we could, or that people tell us we can. We just have to be willing to get to the real root of why things actually function the way they do. We have to be willing to peel back every single layer. We have to be like a child and ask why, 1,000 times. And then look at each of those answers or layers and say, is there an assumption in here we want to keep or we don't want to keep, or do we need further research on it? In our technical and scientific fields, the commitment to use something like a scientific method has given us clean water and electricity and computers and rocket engines and a map of outer space and gene therapy. And it's allowed us to sort of understand, or at least observe, quantum strings, which are particularly amazing because they are approximately 1 millionth of 1 billionth of 1 billionth of 1 billionth of a centimeter long. That is astounding that we know what those things are and we have technology to observe them. Incredible. Now, it's also, it's possible that even our modern scientific field of inquiry and theory, which was basically developed in the late 1600s, is itself too narrow because it excludes almost all qualitative or subjective things in favor of things that must be proven by math. But it is light years beyond the level of critique and concerted effort to systemically improve our political or legal or economic systems, which actually provide very strong incentives to discourage really questioning assumptions or doing things other than perpetuating the status quo. So it's going to be up to us to do all of that. And it's why I started this series, and it's why I hope you're listening to it, so that we can rethink all of these things together. See what I did there? Now, we have the knowledge and understanding of the faults that got unconsciously built into these systems in the past, and the understanding of the faults that many of the people who run these systems today are unconsciously implementing in them. And that is what we're going to talk about next. We need to look for the equivalent of flat earth level assumptions in our legal system or our political system or our economic system. Giant assumptions that have massive consequences and which are so broad and universally believed that most people never even realize that was an assumption that you are allowed to question. That's what we're going to talk about in the next episode. We're going to take the ideas from this episode, which is that most of what's happening to form our ideas and beliefs and our actions is happening well outside and before our conscious awareness, and we're going to discuss some of the ways that things in our subconscious got unintentionally, and sometimes intentionally, built into the systems around us, what the consequences of that are, and we're going to look at some differently designed systems, some right here in the animal kingdom, to give us some insight into how differently things could actually be if we exerted our full level of agency on the world. You might be surprised to learn that bees actually have more effective group decision-making systems that have absolutely no corruption in them, or that bats basically believe in karma and their enforcement of certain rules that hold all members of their group accountable to the same standards improves their survival as a species. We'll talk about some of the mistakes we make, and we'll start to look at some of these places where we can take lessons to incorporate into our thinking in how we implement and design new systems. And these are things that I think we can accomplish. We can accomplish systems change with this level of agency. We can accomplish major systems change in our lifetimes, rather than having to wait for the history books to show our children where we went wrong. Now, I know this was a dense episode and appreciate you sticking through to the end. Not that you had any choice, of course. Please check out the show notes where I've linked to a bunch of sources and further reading. Please reach out to me on social media or through my website if you have any questions or ideas. And I really look forward to talking with more of you soon. And I hope that you consider registering for a virtual chat, which you can do so at rethinkingwithalextorpy.com/events, where I will help introduce you to a few other podcast subscribers, and we will talk about some of these topics in more detail. So thanks again, and I look forward to talking with you soon.